We are.
Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, when the government pulled the plug, she didn't. We'll talk to local farmer Brenda Miller, who's fighting for young farmers after federal funding for the Sullivan County Beginning Farmer Program was frozen. Many energy customers still grappling with steep electricity bills left over from the winter. Those lingering costs have sparked renewed debate over the structure of utility companies and whether public ownership could offer a more affordable alternative. Kimberly Izar reports on the proposal from some state lawmakers that seeks to shift control of one major utility provider into public hands. Inspired by ice, scientists reveal the ancient roots of the Hudson River schools of art, and James B. Huntington with local economic perspective. First, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Vatican says Pope Francis has died in his residence today. He was 88 years old. Francis had been in poor health recently and was recovering from severe pneumonia, but he delighted faithful worshipers only yesterday. He rode the Pope Mobile in St. Peter's Square to bless people on Easter Sunday. World leaders have offered condolences this morning. President Trump said, "Rest in peace, Pope Francis." When a pope dies, there are official procedures that are followed. That ranges from announcing his death to electing a new head of the Roman Catholic Church. NPR's Jason DeRose explains the process.
After a pope dies, a series of Vatican officials gets word before the death is announced to the public. The pope's funeral is usually scheduled within the next 4 to 6 days, allowing cardinals time to travel to Rome. Then, between 15 and 20 days after the pope's death, all cardinals under the age of 80 enter a conclave held in the Sistine Chapel behind sealed doors. They participate in 4 rounds of balloting every day until someone receives 2/3 of the vote. The ballots of the final vote are burned with a special chemical to produce white smoke, announcing to the world the conclave has chosen the new head of the Roman Catholic Church. Jason DeRose, NPR News.
Thousands of protesters turned out at hundreds of events over the weekend in the U.S. They gathered to protest President Trump's policies. Others demonstrated at Tesla showrooms in the U.S. to oppose Tesla CEO Elon Musk. He's been overseeing Trump's government cost-cutting entity, Doge. NPR's Juliana Kim reports there are more protesters turning out.
Hallmark of this protest movement is that demonstrators are joining together with a long and varying list of grievances. You know, it's immigration, it's federal funding cuts, foreign policy. It's too soon to tell how long the momentum will last, but researchers at Harvard's Crowd Counting Consortium said in a Guardian op-ed that between January 22nd and the end of March, street protests have more than doubled compared to the same time frame 8 years ago.
NPR's Juliana Kim reporting. Stocks opened lower this morning as investors brace for some big tech earnings reports this week. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell about 660 points in early trading.
Tesla is due to report earnings tomorrow. The electric car maker has already announced a 13% drop in first quarter auto sales. Google's parent company is set to report earnings on Thursday. The search engine giant was hit last week with a second adverse court ruling when a judge found it built an illegal monopoly in its web advertising business. With President Trump's trade war sowing doubts about the U.S. economy, some investors are putting their bets on Europe and Asia. Billions of dollars flowed out of U.S. stock funds last week, while funds in Europe and Asia were attracting new money. Asian stocks were mixed overnight, up in Shanghai and Seoul, but down in Tokyo. Hong Kong's market was closed. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News. The White House is hosting the annual Easter egg roll today. However, there are ethics questions being raised. NPR's Deepa Shivaram reports that for the first time, the White House has accepted corporate sponsorships for the event.
The event is being put together by an outside production company called Harbinger. They solicited sponsorships that will include Meta, Amazon, and YouTube, which are providing things like photo experiences, a reading nook, and a stage, according to the White House. But promoting private companies at the White House through things like sponsorships has sparked concerns of ethics violations, and it's a departure from the norm for how the Easter egg roll has typically been organized. The potential conflict of interest comes not long after President Trump used the White House to promote cars from Tesla, a company run by his close advisor, Elon Musk. Deepa Shivaram, NPR News.
China is warning other countries against making trade deals with the Trump administration, especially deals that harm Chinese interests. Several countries have launched talks with President Trump and his trade team, including Japan, South Korea, and Vietnam. Some of Trump's tariffs have been put on pause, but others remain in place, such as the worldwide 10% tariffs and others targeting steel and aluminum. Repeating our top story, the Vatican says that Pope Francis has died at his residence today. He had just blessed worshipers in St. Peter Square yesterday who had gathered to celebrate Easter Sunday. Pope Francis was 88 years old. The Vatican says the body of the pontiff will be placed in a coffin later today. This will be in a ceremony at the chapel of the hotel where he lived. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Capital One with the Capital One Saver Card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at MacFound.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. Today on the show, we're diving into a story that hits close to home for the farming community in the Catskills and Hudson Valley. Just as the Beginning Farmer program was gaining momentum, entering its second year of a five-year initiative under the USDA's American Rescue Plan, unexpected federal action from the Trump administration brought it all to a halt. The program, which pairs experienced farmers with young, aspiring growers for hands-on training and support, suddenly had its funding frozen. That left the Cornell Cooperative Extension of Sullivan County, the organization that's running the program, with no choice but to pause operations, leaving 11 mentor farmers and 11 mentees stranded mid-season. So what happens when that lifeline for young farmers is suddenly cut? Joining us now to talk about the impact and what might come next is Brenda Miller, the owner and founder of Bubblelink Farm, located in Liberty, New York, and had participated in the Beginning Farmer program. Good morning.
Good morning, Tim.
Talk about a little bit. Well, before we get into the freeze, give us a brief overview of the farmer program, the Beginning Farmer program. What was it designed to do, and how it operated before this freeze?
Well, I can only speak as a participant and not an employee of Cooperative Extension, but I remember when it was starting, and it came in with such a rush of energy. And they hired a staff person. There was an advisory council of which I was a part and many other local farmers, all different kinds of farmers, different levels of experience, different crops, some with animals. And it brought the community alive in a way. And we started gathering for these farmer mixers, which we're doing on my farm tomorrow night. And it just, for the first time, I think there was this rush of energy to bring everyone together to begin with. And then there was the first mentorship cohort, which I was a part of. And it was designed, to bring together seasoned farmers and beginning farmers. And there was some capital involved. There was a stipend involved on both sides. And then we did workshops. I did a couple workshops on the farm, very hands-on, very well attended, besides the mixers. And what it did, I started this farm in 2019. You can't see in Radio Land, but you can see that I'm not a young beginner farmer. I'm an old beginner farmer. I'm experienced. But, when I was in my 20s, I wanted to start a farm. That's when I first had the vision of doing this. And there was nothing. There's so much involved in farming. You need to know all the science of the crop families. You need to know how to run a business. You need to know how to market a business. You need to know how to find markets for your product. And it's a huge amount of information. And you need a lot of capital to start out. So without those resources, my farm didn't get off the ground until 2019. But here was an opportunity for people who are the age that I was then to get a leg up and to get started in the midst of this very vibrant, very helpful community.
So what was your reaction when you first learned that this federal funding was frozen for the Beginning Farmer program?
Oh, it's just sad. It's senseless. There's no reason for it. It sets us back. You know, the other thing about the beginner farmer that felt so important to me was I'm so aware now that I've been working in agriculture and horticulture all this time, even if I didn't own my own farm. But really owning my own farm, I see how close we are to the brink of not being able to grow food on this planet anymore. And the other part of the beginner farmer is we're all figuring it out together and very closely together and in a way that supports us with the funding. So I also felt like not only is it sad and senseless, it's destructive. Like so many things, it's destructive. And but I also felt strongly that, at least for my part, I will keep doing whatever I can do in the spirit of the beginner farmer program. So like the event tomorrow night will go on no matter what, funding, no funding. I'll be teaching a workshop later in the summer on soil health. That'll go on, funding, no funding. So that's my commitment to it.
So yeah, despite this loss of the federal backing, you've decided to continue this independently. What made you decide to keep going?
Oh, because there's just no question in my mind. I think that's part of farming. I don't think you get into farming because you sort of like it and you think it's okay.
It's not a hobby.
It's not a hobby. It's a passion. And it's a passion for not just growing, but for the planet. And when you have that passion, I hearken back to what I've read before. You have the fierceness that a mother deer has in protecting her fawn. You have that love and fierceness. And I will do anything.
And you mentioned, as we talked about the funding, some of the funding might provide you a stipend to host an event like this. That won't be there. And you're continuing with this, and we'll talk about how folks can get involved or learn more later. But have you seen the support of the community rallying around this effort that you're trying to do to continue this for farmers, younger farmers and farmers in the community?
Well, I think the folks from Extension could speak more clearly to that. But everything that I've heard and everyone I've spoken with has that spirit of we go on, you know, and I've been involved with SALT also. And Marty Colavito, I heard him say, it's not about, I need to continue the work. It's the funding will come. Or something like that. Sorry, Marty, if I'm misquoting you.
Sullivan Allies Leading Together, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
No.
Well, I was going to ask, you know, you've talked about it a little bit, but like you deeply understand the needs of farmers, young farmers in particular. How has this impacted you personally in some ways in terms of carrying on that fight, as you're saying?
Well, personally, the finances are terrifying. I feel like we're all, and no matter where you are as an ordinary person in this country right now, there's some fear. So that can be kind of gripping. But I also feel like it has, it's sort of invigorated me in a way. I feel, again, like the mother deer, I feel like I am more committed probably than ever to doing what I do, sharing it as much as I can, and just plowing on, so to speak.
No pun intended.
farmer
humor there.
It can be. I mean, farming is not, it's very difficult to make money farming. And as an older farmer, it's even more difficult. I'm a beginner and I'm also older, so it's a little bit, not a little bit, it's often very, I'm often on the brink before all this stuff happened. So, but I am committed to continuing on.
Talk a little bit about more tomorrow. What's the event and how can folks get involved?
Okay, so tomorrow is what from the beginner farmer program we called a farmer mixer. But I kind of feel like in my mind, so a farmer mixer would be a gathering we gather at each other's farms, we bring some snacks to share, some drinks to share, and we just chat. And it's such a wonderful experience. And this time, too, it's on Earth Day. So I feel like I wanted to open it up a little bit as the host farm to whoever wants to come. Come and have snacks, bring snacks, have drinks, bring drinks. And I'll give a tour of my farm that I've been working on now since 2019. And we'll talk a little bit about Earth Day. We'll share our own feelings about Earth Day. And we can celebrate. We live in an amazing, amazing planet. And the beauty of spring and the beauty of our Earth, we need to stay centered in that. In order to fight, we need to stay centered in that.
Something special about doing this on Earth Day, too.
Yes, it was intentional.
I see what you did there. So it's a farm tour and potluck at Bobolink Farm tomorrow from 5 to 7. To get more information, RSVP, you're asking folks to let you know who's coming?
RSVP to Cornell Cooperative Extension, Sullivan County.
Yep.
But you know what? If you don't get a chance to RSVP, just show up at 5 o'clock.
And you're here in Liberty off of Route 55, Bobolink Farm, Brenda Miller. The email is beginnerfarmer@cornell.edu. And again, more information at sullivancce.org. Before we go, just one thing you want to leave folks with about this current state of where we are in farming and what it means for the community to gather and continue on.
To me, it's the most important thing. Gathering with our neighbors, helping each other, knowing that we're all in this together. I see it kind of like the pandemic, only in some ways a little scarier, but in a lot of ways the same spirit of we will get through this together. We will get through this with our neighbors. We are powerless over so much of it, but I know I can still grow food. I know we can grow food together. I know we can share how we're getting through the challenges, and I know that we can come together and laugh and enjoy and have gratitude.
Well, we have gratitude for you. You're one of our good neighbors as well, just down the road here in Liberty.
Oh, thank you so much, Tim. I'm so grateful for Radio Catskill and for you too.
Brenda Miller from Bobolink Farm, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, talking about the possibility of turning the public utilities into private utilities into public hands is what I'm trying to say. That's next on Radio Catskill.
Hey there, I'm Jason Dole, reminding you that public media is under serious threat. Efforts to eliminate federal funding could disrupt everything that you rely on from Radio Catskill. These funds help us provide listeners like you with crucial information, from life-saving emergency alerts to local news. But if federal funding vanishes, we could lose all these essential community services. The stakes have never been higher. Visit protectmypublicmedia.org and tell Congress to protect Radio Catskill while there's still time.
Next time on the Retro Cocktail Hour, Nat King Cole goes Latin. A trip to Disney's Adventureland and the new exotic sounds of the Voodoo Five. I'm Daryl Brogdon. Why not join me where the music's always shaken, not stirred? The Retro Cocktail Hour. Wednesday night at 7, here on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Winter's wrapped up, but many energy customers are still left having to pay those high electricity bills from the past season. Some lawmakers argue it's because the companies are privately owned, but what would it look like if your local utility company was publicly owned? Introduced by District 103 Assemblymember Sharana Shrestha and New York Senator Michelle Henchy, the Hudson Valley Power Authority Act proposes to create a publicly owned corporation that would acquire Central Hudson Gas and Electric Corporation and run it with no profit motive. Central Hudson is currently privately owned by Fortis Incorporated, a Canadian holding company. It services the Mid-Hudson Valley area, including Ulster, Sullivan, and Orange counties. Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar spoke with Assemblymember Shrestha about how the state bill would work.
So why don't we start with what this bill would actually do? How would the Hudson Valley Power Authority Act work, and what exactly would it do?
Sure. So, you know, our investor-owned utilities like Central Hudson, for example, We have seven of them that are legal monopolies, right? They're for-profit corporate monopolies that serve a specific area, their service territory, and the service they're providing is just the distribution of energy. So it's not the supply and generation. It's not even really the transmission. It's just bringing energy from the grid to people's homes, the buildings, and so on. So one of the things that's happening is that the delivery rates are really going up, and there's a reason why that's happening. You know, the basic one being that these utilities are allowed to pass 100% of their operating costs, 100% of their capital costs, and 100% of their financialization costs to their ratepayers. Plus, they are also authorized to earn a certain level of profits based on this factor called the rate of return on equity. And the more they spend on capital projects, which are things that, you know, that you build that last for more than 10 years, the more they can earn profits based on this formula that uses this ROE factor. So all that means is that it is a way to fund the distribution infrastructure in the way that makes least sense for the ratepayer, mm-hmm. because it's the most expensive way of doing it. So we want to replace it with a not-for-profit corporation. Public authorities are the model that really became popular during the 1930s when the country was really trying to figure out how to come out of the Great Depression, how to deal with the post-Second World War era and make like massive infusion of public investments. So this is a model where these entities can act like normal corporations, except they are owned by the public. So in this case, by the state.
Yeah, and this isn't the first time that utility companies are publicly owned. Are there some examples that you can point to help people understand what it could look like?
Yes. So if you look at the history of when electricity became available for mass consumption, there was actually not a consensus if it should be privately owned or publicly owned. There was always a debate, right? And what happened was there was really a momentum for public ownership because lots of different areas, like, for example, rural areas in the country, they were not getting electricity as a universal service because it was not profitable enough for the companies to provide that service. Similarly, in all these new urban hotspots that were emerging from when people were moving from rural areas to like dense areas, there was really an inequity in who was getting to use electricity as a basic service. So during that time, what happened was to solve this issue, lots of publicly owned as well as cooperative, municipal owned electric service providers came up. And in fact, in Canada, they went mostly with public power, and across the board in the United States, it was like there was some public power, but the private sector made a deal to let them serve as private companies. And in return, they would allow the state to regulate them. So this is the dominant arrangement that we have, where you have a corporate monopoly, they're private, they're for profit, they're owned by somebody else, but the state is allowed to regulate them. There are publicly owned utilities all over the country in various sizes. The one big one is, you know, the Tennessee Valley Authority that FDR created. In the state of Nebraska, there are zero investor-owned utilities. So they're all either municipal or cooperative. But what we don't have is sort of the model utility for a new era that is not just for one town, that is not just for a strict border, but that is like covering, as you mentioned in the beginning of the program, lots of counties, right? It's like Ulster County, Dutchess County, but also parts of Putnam County, you know? So right. We're trying to create the most innovative and the modern version of it, building on the legacy of publicly owned utilities that already exist. And new data shows that in the last few years, you can see that the rates went up for privately owned utilities much higher than inflation, and for publicly owned utilities much lower than inflation. So even as is, we already have this track record to show that there really is no way of keeping rates low as long as for-profit business is allowed to be involved in this.
Yeah, that's super interesting, kind of that backstory and history, and also what would make the Hudson Valley Power Authority different and particular for the modern era, I think is really interesting. I'm curious what kind of traction you've seen so far from both customers as well as lawmakers.
There is a lot of interest, and this is one of the reasons we sort of rushed to, you know, finish this bill and introduce it, because in the beginning we were really thinking about it as like, well, this is, you know, going to be our long-term fight priority and so on. But the reason we decided to move forward with the bill, and we were, you know, so excited that Senator Hinchey was enthusiastic about the bill from the beginning, is because we have hit this dead end, really, where people no longer have answers for how to keep these rates low, because people are experiencing an affordability crisis that is hitting them from multiple angles, right? We have huge housing issues. We have supply chain issues that pass on costs to everything that we use. We have, generally speaking, energy issues coming from, you know, geopolitical wars or whatever it is that is driving up inflation and so on. So it is a moment where we feel like the conditions are ripe for people to be interested in why this could be a solution. And that is what we are seeing right now, is that your average ratepayer is very curious about this bill. When we go knock doors, talk to people, people are very eager to learn what this is going to do, which is why the coalition that is supporting this bill, Hudson Valley for Public Power, they've been holding monthly orientations open to the public. People can come, watch the presentation, and ask any questions that they want. So there's a lot of interest. What's at stake is not just the benefits for the customers of Central Hudson, but really for the rest of the state and the country to have a model that is working and to build on that. Because if you have one successful model, I think it's way more easy to try to replicate that success against other utilities.
One thing I want to do to spend a little bit of time doing is kind of demystifying some of the finances behind this. I want to talk a little bit more about how, if at all, this would impact taxpayers. How exactly would the Power Authority be financed exactly? And how is that different than how Central Hudson is currently financed?
Yes. So that is a very good question, because it's one of the things that people are not really thinking about in their everyday life. And also, so much of our corporate financing is basically based on this imaginary money, you know, so it confuses a lot of people. Different types of public authorities can be designed to be financed in different ways. For example, transit authorities are often subsidized by taxpayer money, because that's the only way to keep the fares very, very low. In contrast to that, energy power authorities are historically not subsidized by taxpayers, because the service it provides can be paid for by the revenues it collects through these guaranteed bills that people are going to pay, you know? So there, it has the balance where the entire financing can just be through the revenues collected through bills. And how it does that financing is exactly how Central Hudson does it, which is that it will issue debt, you know, it will issue bonds. The only difference is, in our case, there's not going to be any shareholders, right? No shareholders will be investing. We won't be sending dividends to shareholders, to Fortis. We'll be financing strictly through issuing debts. And the public authority model is designed to make this type of financing as cheap and safe as possible.
So where is the bill exactly?
So we introduced it, I think we introduced it end of last session, which is like around June of 2024.
Okay.
And where it is right now is, you know, the Coalition Hudson Valley for Public Power has formed, and there are a few member coalitions working pretty regularly and actively on the organizing component. For example, the city of Kingston unanimously passed a resolution in support of this bill, and that took a significant level of knocking doors, making sure that these council members have understood the bill, that they have heard from their constituents, that the constituents understand what it does, that they haven't fallen for the misinformation campaign that has already begun, you know? So it's quite a vast service territory. And I think there's like, you know, almost 100, if not over 100 local governments in this territory. And we want to build support for as many of those as possible. So the thing that is happening very actively is this grassroots organizing, because we really believe strongly that the only way to win it, and the only way to win it correctly, is with a bottom-up effort. And I don't think we can win this by a few people at the top saying, okay, we're going to do this, and everybody else just accepts that answer. Like, I don't think it's really going to work that way. And it's going to be, you know, it's going to take quite a bit of time and effort and strategy and volunteers to do this organizing work, but it is growing steadily. So that's very exciting to see.
And thanks to Kimberly Eisenhower for that report. We'll take a break, and when we come back, local economic perspective from James B. Huntington. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale. Dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Hi, this is Marco Werman, host of The World. Weekdays at 3, our newsroom connects you with events around the globe. Our reporters in the Americas, Africa, Europe, and Asia get to the heart of the day's news. We bring you international perspectives on issues worldwide and here in the U.S. It's 1 hour each day that broadens horizons and takes you beyond our borders. Join me on The World, afternoons at 3, on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Stocks fell again Monday as President Donald Trump ramped up his attacks on Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell, and traders received little signs of progress on global trade talks. Here to break it down for us with some local economic perspective, local author, local economist James B. Huntington. Good morning, James B.
Good morning, Tim. Good morning, listeners.
Yeah, James B. Mentioned how stocks were doing. We'll get a look at the numbers later, but are there some signs that we might already be in a recession?
Yes. Recessions are not as clear to define as some people might think. This is a piece by Vox, actually. They're saying that recessions are always officially declared after they have already started. And the National Bureau of Economic Research, for one, defines a recession as a significant decline in economic activity that is spread across the economy. Notice the lack of any quantitative thing there. But what they're mentioning as reasons why we could be in a recession already are, number one, consumer confidence is declining. It is going down. We have the tariffs and such, especially the threat of them has been driving down consumer demand. People can't necessarily change what they're doing depending on whether the tariffs are paused or removed entirely or continued. So it's generally going down and staying down. Number two, the bond market is flashing a warning sign. The disturbing thing there is that the U.S. Treasury yields on the long bonds we have, which finance a lot of our debt, has gone up, relatively up, because people are concerned about the American economy and the American dollar, which has been going down significantly over the last few weeks. Number three, gas prices are coming down, and probably not for a good reason. The good reason, the not good reason, is that one thing dropping oil prices can show is lower economic activity, and that's what we have here. So we don't have any word that we're in a recession now, and we may not, and it probably will remain controversial no matter what. And these factors are not particularly huge. I'm not seeing anything about lower jobs being filled or announced or anything like that, or anything widespread as far as something's a causes for people to not be happy about the economy. So, but we could be on the edge, we could be close to it, depending on what definition you want to use, but it's not worth worrying about it all by yourself. What counts is the situation we're actually in, not what we label it.
Right. Keeping an eye on that. Let's talk about a local career and tech job fair that's coming up at Boese. Where is that?
Yes, this is April 30th. That's a week from Wednesday. It will be at Boese's. We have a morning session running from 8:30 to 10:30 a.m., and then an afternoon session from 11:45 a.m. to 2:00 p.m. So we're looking for people there, especially employers. I don't know what they have established for this, but this is mainly something for students, although I'm sure other people could go there in some capacity to look for jobs. So if you want more information, contact the school. The names are Brianna Worden, W-O-R-D-E-N, and Bruce Gettel, G-E-T-T-E-L. We have that information for you if you are curious.
We'll get that up on the website too. You've got a report on how there's a downside of some blue-collar workers. What is that downside?
Well, we've been hearing a lot of relatively good things about blue-collar work, especially trades, how they're paying more and more and people can get to work and start earning money sooner in their lives. But something that is not looking very good, according to Pew Research, is that generally blue-collar workers are less satisfied with their jobs than others. They feel less respected, less attached to their jobs, and they're more likely to view their jobs as just a way to get by rather than a career. The problems tend to be the strongest for people who are younger and for people who are women. So some things we have here is generally lower job satisfaction, although not by a huge margin. We have people complaining that their pay is not keeping up with cost of living increases. 80% people with blue-collar jobs and other jobs are saying that right now. We have them being less likely, substantially less likely, like 56% as opposed to 33% saying they think of their jobs as being a career. Then you have more blue-collar workers saying they're going to look for a new job soon, so about 30% of them are expecting to find something else. What kind of job it is, we don't have specified here. But then we have only less than a third, actually, of such workers say that most Americans have a lot or even a fair amount of respect for the work they do. So it's still getting underrated, and that compares to half of other workers. So about a third say they need more education and training to get ahead at work, which is much the same as everybody else. So these obviously are not determining what individuals think, if you're a good fit, but if you're not sure about how good a fit you are for positions like that, you may not want to pursue them because you may be less happy than you might expect.
I don't want to be unhappy. Let's talk about the numbers. Can we talk about happiness there? How are the stock, oil, and other prices going this morning? How they change?
Okay. Well, as very early this morning or right now, depending on what's happening, gold was $33.88 early this morning, up $157. It's gold loves all this chaos, and it's up $350 from 2 weeks ago to this morning. Today, it's up another $29. Wow. Silver, $32.75, up 58 cents for a ratio of 103 point something to one. It gained some, but not the same percentage as gold. So as of this morning, it's up only 6 cents, so it's much the same. Ratio is about 104 to 1 now. Dow Jones Industrial Average, 39,142 from week to week. It dropped almost 1,100, and it's down another 700 this morning there. Quite unhappy about the comments, the back and forth between Trump and the Fed and what could go on and the general weakening of the dollar. NASDAQ dropped 438 to 16,286 week to week, and it's now down about a little over 400, so it's doing even worse proportionally. Oil, West Texas Intermediate, has stayed around the same. It's still in the 60s, but it hasn't really achieved much of anything as far as lower pump prices, unfortunately. Not that I've seen, anyway. Bitcoin, 87,615, up 32.32, doing well for now. British pound, 1.3420, up $2, 2.6 cents. That's the dollar keeps on dropping, and that's what goes up, along with the euro, which is at 1.1567, or up 1.79 cents. It's much the same. And then the Japanese, 71 cents for the 100 yen coin, which is up a penny. It's a multi-year high. So overall, the dollar's not as well received as before. It's not inducing a lot of enthusiasm for people keeping it. The U.S. may turn out to be an outlier, people are wondering. So look at the euro, the pound, and the yen as being possible sources for people putting money who don't want to be so dependent on the dollar the way our government is going right now. Yeah. So we'll see.
Keeping an eye on it. Dollar falling.
Pretty punk now.
Yeah, punk, exactly. Dollar falling to its lowest level since 2022. Keeping an eye on it. All for us is our own local economist and author, James B. Huntington. James B., thank you so much.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you, listeners.
And we'll take a break, and when we come back, the Hudson River Schools of Art and their Ice Age origins. You're listening to Radio Chatsko.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, independent grassroots global news. Our reporting includes breaking daily news headlines and in-depth interviews with people on the front lines of the world's most pressing issues. People speaking for themselves, providing unique and sometimes provocative perspectives on global events. Democracy Now!, weekdays at noon, right here on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Well, the natural beauty of the Catskills has inspired artists, writers, and even architects. It's also inspired scientists. Robert and Johanna Titus are retired professors of geology and biology who have written many books and articles about the Catskill Mountains and the Hudson Valley. Their most recent book is The Hudson River Schools of Art and Their Ice Age Origins, explains how the enormous ice sheet created not just the stunning landscape of the Catskill Mountains, but how it ultimately created inspiration for classic 19th century novels, popular city parks, and magnificent oil paintings. Robert and Johanna Titus will be giving a presentation of Ice Age Origins of the Hudson River Schools of Art at the Time and the Valleys Museum in Grahamsville on Sunday the 27th. Radio Catskill contributor Tracy Gates spoke with them about how they arrived at such an interesting subject, as well as some of their favorite places to imagine the Catskills as it was 20,000 years ago.
So the title of your book, Ice Age Origins of the Hudson River Schools of Art, is interesting to me on so many levels. My head has been bouncing from imagining the Ice Age to thinking about art and how one subject in some ways created others. I'd really love for you, the two of you, to tell me a bit about what led you to this really interesting subject and the title of your book.
Well, I think to begin with, we're very well aware, because we're, I guess, what you would call residents of the Hudson Valley, that there's a literature that is associated with the valley, like James Fenimore Cooper and Washington Irving and so on. And that got us kind of more curious. And then we go drive up and down the Hudson Valley every day, just about, and we notice architecture. And so you get curious, who did this architecture? Why did they do it? When did they do it? And that brought us to the fact that there wasn't just the School of Art. There was also the architecture, and there was also the literature.
And I'd like to add the words 19th century. I think when we talk about Hudson Valley culture, we're mostly assuming the great work by the artists, the writers, the architects during the 19th century. That's when the Hudson Valley came into its own.
Yeah, I found that interesting, too. I'm a student of literature, and I love to be out in the Catskills. But the 19th century, who was really working then? I assume you address all of this in your book. But could you speak a little to the 19th century and why that was so important to this book?
Well, it was when people were first arriving in the Catskills and the Hudson Valley. So it was something that was brand new to them. They were spreading out from the metropolitan, if you will, more metropolitan area of New York City and Philadelphia, and stretching their legs and seeing what they could find.
This was the first time that Americans were looking at the wilderness. This is before the great immigration across all of North America. This was penetration into the Catskills, and they saw a genuine, authentic wilderness. And that was so inspiring, obviously, to the artists, but also to the writers and later on to the architects. We're just a few years ago was the 200th anniversary of the writing of Rip Van Winkle. This year is the 200th anniversary of Thomas Cole's first visit up the Hudson Valley. It was these brilliant communicators dealing with awfully pretty landscape and awfully handsome landscape. It was inspirational to these people.
Yeah, it's always inspiring to me whenever I'm hiking in the Catskills, for sure. I love that you connect these three arts, to the Ice Age. And I was just thinking a little bit about how people, not like yourselves, but people like me, use the Ice Age, that term, and don't really think about when it took place or how it affects the landscape around us. Could you define the Ice Age for us a little bit more?
What we call the Ice Age in our book started about 25,000 years ago. And the climax of this Ice Age was from 12 to 20,000 years ago, when first a great glacier swept down the Hudson Valley, rose up and filled the Hudson Valley, and then swept into the Catskills, reaching an elevation today of more than 4,000 feet. Imagine for a moment the erosion that an advancing glacier would do on a landscape, and then melt all of that ice and imagine all the erosion that meltwater, that raging, foaming, pounding, thundering torrents of meltwater would also do on the landscape. What we are arguing is that this glaciation had an enormous influence on shaping the beauty of the Hudson Valley and the Catskills. And it was that beauty that again inspired these great humanists, these artists, these writers, these architects, these people who were not scientists, but saw what the science of the Ice Age had done to our region.
Wow. Where are some places that we could go to really see evidence of this? I mean, obviously, it seems like anywhere in the Catskills, really. But
that's exactly right. Everywhere.
If you want to go have a sort of summary of the Ice Age, you could drive up Route 23A up Catterskill Cove, which you could stop at Bastion Falls. You could go to Catterskill Falls, North South Lake State Park. And in North South Lake State Park, there is a trail that goes out to the escarpment, out to the Catskill Front. And you can see the whole valley.
I'd like your listeners someday to go to the Catskill Mountain House Hotel site, which towers above the Hudson Valley on the escarpment, on the edge of the Great Escarpment. Stand as close to the edge as you're comfortable. Look to the north, and in your mind's eye, imagine it becoming frigid, it becoming arctic, and a glacier appears in the far distant north. It advances down the valley. It sweeps below you. It's heading towards Kingston. And then it swells up. It rises. The ice gets higher and higher and higher. And you're standing there and looking at this happening. The ice reaches all the way up to the edge of the escarpment where you are standing. If you can imagine such a thing, if you can experience such a thing, it's almost overwhelming. It's a breathtaking experience of the imagination, but it's based on hard science. It's something that really did happen.
Well, I definitely want to do that now. Although I'm really glad that I don't live in the Ice Age. You're going to have images at this presentation. Could you talk about a little bit about them? Because I feel like looking at some of the images in your book, it really shows you how huge this, what do you call it, the ice, not field, but...
Ice sheet.
Thank you.
Yeah, the best term is ice sheet, covering almost all of North America.
Oh, my gosh.
And rising to an elevation which is now more than 4,000 feet, may have been 6,000 feet, I'd like your listeners to look out the nearest window and look 4,000 feet into the sky and then imagine that was all ice. Think about that for a minute.
I don't really want to, but yeah, that does give one a sense. I also wanted to ask you about how the Ice Age, you really describe how it impacted the Catskills in a really beautiful way. In fact, you use the word sculpt the Catskills. Could you speak a little bit more about that?
Oh, golly. Let's take you up another mountain. Go down to Overlook Mountain at towers above Woodstock and climb to the elevation. I think it's about 3,200 feet. And then, having read our book and seen some of the illustrations in it, walk around and you are standing up there. The Hudson Valley is 2,500 feet below you, and your feet are standing on glacial striations, scratches gouged into the bedrock up there by the glacier that overran all of that mountain, right to the top of that mountain and beyond. You're looking down and you're seeing evidence of a glacier that was there, 20,000 years ago. And then you're looking into the Hudson Valley as it is today. And again, it's just a breathtaking experience, which the artist painted without knowing that there had been glaciers there.
Right, right. Sorry, did you want to say something, Johanna?
No, it's okay. We can argue back and forth for individual artists who knew about the Ice Age and who didn't. Johann is far more interested in the history of what these people learned about the Ice Age, and they were aware of it. I should restate myself. They were aware of the Ice Age. They sure didn't know a whole lot of the details.
I see. Do you have favorite authors, architects that you wanted to talk about a little bit and or that you will be speaking about at your presentation at the time and the Valleys Museum?
I think both of us agree on the same artist, and that's Sanford Robinson Gifford. We love his use of color. We love choices he made and where he would sketch for his paintings. And we have personally visited so many of the locations where he stood and sketched. We've taken turns putting our feet where we think he put his feet during the 1860s and looking exactly at what he looked at back then and seeing exactly what he saw back then. It sends shivers up your spine to realize that you're occupying the space, the very spot where a great artist did a great painting. Johanna, I think you can speak to the architects better than I.
As far as a favorite goes, I guess Olmsted. Olmsted was the most prolific. He's considered the father of landscape architecture.
That's Frederick. Sorry to interrupt. That's Frederick Law Olmsted. Correct. Yes.
Yes, and he did the majority of the planning for the urban parks, the big urban parks like Central Park and the parks in Boston. What he did was really brilliant. Where he didn't see what he wanted to see, he literally transformed it. He built what he wanted to see where he wanted to see it.
We have a close friend, Bob Gildersleeve, who lives up here, and he's made a practice of learning this sort of thing. He had people from Central Park visit North Lake, and he took them hiking, and they all agreed that the landscape up there must have been influential in the creation of Central Park.
Oh, that's really interesting. And I think also Prospect Park, perhaps, that Olmsted did.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I've spent time in both. They're just wonderful. They just have such a lovely, wild feeling in certain parts. So I can see that. Mm-hmm.
The landscape architecture, remember, was created. It wasn't there, and they just manipulated it to look better, look more pretty. They actually built it. They built the streams and the waterfalls and the little grottos.
Actually, I wanted to just mention with the book, you do say that this is a book for people who aren't just scientists. They're for people like myself that are just curious about this area and how it was formed. Did you really think about your audience while you were writing the book?
Oh, intensely.
Absolutely.
We are very intensely writing at a level which can appeal to everybody. You're going to find very little. You find no scientific techno garble in our book, or I think any of our books. We're very experienced. We've been doing this for 33 years. We've been communicating to the average reader, and I think doing it successfully.
Yeah, and we want people to be able to go on a Sunday afternoon and take a picnic and go to a spot and look and be astounded by the fact that where they're sitting having their picnic was created by the Ice Age.
Yeah, I love that. I like being just more feeling more connected to a place. And, you know, you can go and just appreciate it, but just feeling like you know something about it. Where can people buy your book or borrow it?
It's not yet available on Amazon.
Okay.
So you have to go online, run a search on Purple Mountain Press. You will get to their website. And there's a page where you can place orders for their books, including ours.
Oh, wonderful. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Everybody should go to their local library and have their local library get the book. Because it belongs in every Catskill library and every Hudson Valley library.
Well, I work in a library, actually. And yes, I will make sure that we carry it.
By the end of the day, Tracy.
Okay. I'll get over there next. Well, it's been a pleasure to speak with you. I'm going to reiterate again that you'll be speaking on Sunday, April 27th at 2 p.m. at the Time and the Valleys Museum in Grahamsville. And if I'm available, I'm definitely going to be there.
Great. Please say hello.
Yes.
Thanks to Radio Catskill contributor Tracy Gates for that report. That's going to do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Calicoon Theater, an updated vintage movie theater with new releases, film festivals, nostalgic screenings, live music events, and more. Information and schedule at thecalicoontheater.com.
WJFF Jeffersonville. This is Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR.